This is Bird Note. To join the Great Backyard Bird Count, one of the biggest community science events of the year, you don't even need a backyard. You just need 15 minutes and an interest in birds. Over the course of 4 days in February, the Great Backyard Bird Count gathers heaps of info about birds all over the world and helps people connect with their local birds. If you're new to identifying birds, you can download the Merlin Bird ID app to help figure out which species you're encountering based on looks and sound. If you already recognize your neighborhood birds, you can use eBird to submit a list of every species you see or hear during the count. And you can submit as many checklists as you want during the event. It's a great opportunity to bring friends or family along with you to the backyard or a nearby park and help them have their first birding experience. You'll submit a shared checklist with all the species you observed as a group. The event begins tomorrow and ends on Monday. Learn more at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, online at cjsf.ca. Broadcasting from Burnaby, B.C. Home of McFog the Dog.
Hello there, and welcome to this week's episode of the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Hale, and with me, as usual, is Brandon. And today, we also have a very special guest, David. Today's episode is actually something a little bit different. We're going to be talking about the philosophy, the theory, and the use of philosophy in sports and sporting activities. I think we're going to cover a wide range of topics. It's going to be a lot of fun. Today, I decided to stick with the theme and really go with a philosophical or a philosopher's quote specifically about sports. This is a pretty famous one. This is by Albert Camus. I feel like probably a lot of our listeners know who that is, a famous French kind of lumped in with the existentialists from the 1930s and 40s. French guy, well, actually French-Algerian, and he famously said, "All that I know most surely about morality and obligations I owe to football." So let me say that one more time. "All that I know most surely about morality and obligations I owe to football." Camus was a semi-professional football player back in the 1930s. For a long period of his life, he really credited football with having an enormous impact on how he behaved or thought about morality. He wrote about how football or sports in general, maybe David, you'd agree with this, maybe you don't, feel free to jump in, but morality and discipline, Camus viewed sports as a training ground for ethics, emphasizing loyalty, rules, and collective, freely accepting obligations. Basically, when we enter into a sporting event, you know, we commit to rules, we commit to playing a certain kind of game. And that's not just a singular thing, that's a commitment that we make collectively as a unit. He also wrote about innocent passion. He identified Sunday football matches, as well as the theater, actually, as the only place where he felt truly innocent and sincere, finding a form of escape from the absurd yet demanding nature of modern existence. And then finally, solidarity. despite the individualism of his position as a goalkeeper, he highly valued the team, camaraderie, and the shared simple aspects of that. Of that teamwork together, even though he had a position that was as a goalkeeper, kind of seemed like singular on its own. Really, he was always operating as a team member.
Quite often times, like, athletes are just athletes. When athletes are playing, all they see is the sport. All they see is what they're doing right in front of them. Just the way he was talking about some of these things, it really struck me that so much of what comes behind sports is so much past a physical activity. It's so much past the fame. It's so much past an activity or an income, which is what a lot of the actual participants in the sport gravitate towards. You know, do you guys know what I'm see the distinction?
Yep,
the,
totally.
Yeah. It's interesting that he talks about like a particular commitment to like one sport and how it has these, like, we might call goods internal to the practice of that sport. But there, I find that there is almost like a and this might be what like characterizes an athlete as opposed to like a goalkeeper or like, you know, a basketball player or something. It's like, it's one thing to say that you're dedicated to a particular sport, but being dedicated to sports per se, that in itself is sort of like a particular form of life that you have maybe shared with other sports. So like there's discipline kind of shared between like waking up to go to hockey practice versus like football practice or something like that. But all people kind of like participate in this. I'm using like a Wittgenstein term, like a form of life that you accept once you dedicate yourself to sports, right? And that the fact that it shapes your life is not just like, okay, well, I got to do this if I want to get good at this practice. It's like, I'm actually kind of making a decision about the kind of life I'm going to live by dedicating myself to a particular sport or sports. If it really has like as deep an impact in your life, it's going to cut across all kinds of different particular sports.
Sure, the athletes will share across each other a certain same form of life, but also internally within sports, there's an unspoken, not really unspoken, but there is a hierarchical level of like, oh, you see a gymnast, you know, gymnasts are probably top tier athletes based on the rigorous training that they train. Like, I think a lot of it comes down to discipline and mental fortitude are two things that are really, really highly celebrated in the sports world. And while, yes, the flashy, the footballs, the basketballs, the baseballs, the high paying sports do get a lot of extra, I would say, hierarchy steps because of their clout, if we can say that. But there is internally still a respect for the sports that may not necessarily be as popular, but they do require a great deal of discipline and mental fortitude. Like, that, I think, is a very highly touted series of qualities within athletic realm.
Obviously, sports is such a diverse area, and the way that we think about sports is so diverse. And it ranges really from like, I like how earlier you were talking about committing to like forms of life, right? Like, if I'm going to be a hockey player, I'm not only going to commit just to like hockey as like a game, but I'm also going to commit to all the things that sort of grow out of being a hockey player, right? Like the community, the getting up in the morning, the training, language. The being involved, the language is a huge thing, right? Learning how to speak. Like, I would feel, if you threw me in like a hockey locker room, I would feel uncomfortable. And part of that would be the linguistic like divide. I don't know how to speak in a hockey locker room.
Also racial. I'd like to add to that as well. Like, there's racial elements in each sport. Hockey is a very white sport. You go to football, basketball, very black sports. Is it now a racial element involved into that?
But then I was gonna say too. But then there's also sports that are very singular, right? Like, I was watching the other day, I'm sure maybe I'm sure you know who Alex David knows who Alex Honnold is, and I'm sure many of our listeners know who Alex Honnold is. Maybe Brandon, you don't. But he's the famous, you know, the famous free solo climber. He's the guy that climbs mountains and stuff, but without ropes and harnesses. He just climbs. It's a specific kind of sport. It's widely regarded as like the most dangerous sport in the world for obvious reasons, because if you make any kind of mistake, like you die is basic, you're literally climbing like, you know, hundreds or thousands of feet in the air on these mountains. And if you slip and fall, there's no, like it's over. And I was, he recently did a thing for Netflix where he climbed a Taipei 101, which is one of the tallest buildings in the world. He free soloed it. So no harnesses, no ropes, no parachute, nothing to catch him. And like, that's an athletics feat and sport all on its own that is like very distinct and operates in a completely different way than any other sport. And it was interesting watching not just him, but the other sports people involved in that, as they kind of made it into a little bit of a spectacle, of course, right? Like they had like a panel watching him and commentators, and like the way they were talking about that kind of stuff was very unique to that really specific kind of sporting event, because it is so different from hockey or basketball or even other solo sports, say like swimming, you know, or whatever it might be. I know some swimming is solo, some's not, but it's just interesting to see how there's a whole world that's created, a linguistic world, a thought world, a communal world around a specific sport, that is unique to that sport and doesn't necessarily translate over. However, you can kind of pick apart pieces from that that then can be carried over to other sports or other activities in one life, things like discipline and all that kind of stuff, etc.
Yeah. I mean, sports, to use another, like I'm using the term form of life, let's use another Wittgensteinian term. Sports have a lot of like overlap with each other, but it, you know, if we've read Wittgenstein, we know that it's very difficult to define like a game. Not even all sports are games in particular. So like extreme climbing or something like that, you know, we think of sports as being games, so like football, basketball, etc. But extreme climbing isn't a game, but it's a sport. I think, you know, something like mixed martial arts as well would qualify as something like that, a sport, but not necessarily a game. But the kind of family resemblance, Wittgenstein would say, they sort of resemble each other like members of a family do. You know, they have differences that you can't, differences and similarities that you can't exactly pin down, but you know that they are sort of grouped together like a family. So it's interesting to see that as well, that they do have like niche particularities in these like particular worlds that you're saying as well. I was on the like the topic of like the spectacle and spectators and spectatorship as well. I was thinking in particular of just how like, and this goes to the value of sports as well, I think, just commenting on this. I recently started a job like at Costco, right? It's a very, it is a very busy place. A lot of people go to shop at Costco. And the most busy day on Costco is Saturday evening. Everyone is there getting their stuff and getting ready for the week. But Saturday, November 1st, 2025, it was dead there. There was nobody there. And you want to know why? Because it was the last game of the Blue Jays and Dodgers in the World Series. There was nobody there. Everyone was home watching the Blue Jays. So that sports could have such a, not just a particular, it's not just like a particular world. It reaches to every sort of like, it's a very common thing. People really value this stuff. They go and they watch this. They dedicate time to it. Sports is, as much as people dedicate themselves, the particular athletes dedicate themselves to sports and make the spectacle happen, there is almost like kind of a spectacle of the spectacle itself, just the fact that it has such reverberations throughout not just particular communities or particular worlds, but it has very wide, very like widespread effects on the world in particular. And I'm using like the Costco example, you know, it's Saturday. Everyone should be here. Nobody's here. Everyone is home watching the Blue Jays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one thing that again struck me as you were saying was the spectacle isn't based on the skill in a lot of ways. There is a huge draw, and obviously we know athletes get paid an absurd amount, and we can go into that forever, but you cannot deny the cultural element, the connectivity element, the draw between humans that it creates, that the bond it builds. Like, that's a very important human experience that we just rally around purely because we like the same sport. And when you look at the same team, and when you look at I like, as you were talking, Brian, sort of came to my mind, like, oh, people in Egypt, I'm from Egypt originally, our soccer is nowhere near as good as it is in Europe, but people in Egypt are way more diehard than Europe. So it's like, it's not even skill related. It's just purely a, I don't know. I don't know what that is.
The communal spectacle aspect, right? The inclusion of everybody. Do you say, like, something that was kind of popping in, like, David, you've experienced, because you've played both football at a pretty high level, and you've played, or not played, but you've done MMA at pretty high level. Like, have you noticed a distinct difference in, like, how people think or relate to those two separate kinds of sports? Like, how do you feel about the differences in the relationship with those? Because those are quite distinctly different as sport activities.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think it becomes extra interesting when you talk specifically about fighting. There's something that comes in when you talk about fighting that's very primal, that puts fighting as a sport in its own sort of category. Mm-hmm. That's a very, very difficult question to answer, because we're looking at like football, like American rules football and fighting. You put me in, played soccer when I was younger as well. You put soccer and you put football, and yeah, like, again, I'm referring to American football here, but like American football required a lot more aggression than soccer typically does. And you do see everyone really makes fun of soccer players for being quote unquote soft. And you watch someone like get touched in the head and they have to drop. And that's, again, part of the soccer spectacle. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you see a huge difference between soccer and football in terms of that. But you still see the underlying layer of discipline. You see the underlying layer of skill. Obviously, a little competition here and there. All that stuff is very healthy and very good, and you see that differently in different sports. But then when you get into football and then fighting, it's a huge, huge, huge gap. And that, I think, is because fighting is very primal. I think fighting is something that's very deep within human beings in a lot of ways. And a lot of different people are drawn to fighting for different reasons, whether it's spectacle-wise or participation-wise.
Well, and fighting is one of the oldest sports like that we still do, right? Like, you know, the ancient Greek Olympics included fighting, I believe. Brandon, you correct me, but I believe there was various forms of wrestling. But also, too, I know in a lot of Mesoamerican cultures, pre-contact, like fighting, like various fighting sports were very popular. And also, too, within Eurasia as well, like with the Mongolians and stuff like that. Like, one of their primary sports was fighting. So that's always been, I think, as David is saying, there's always been this primal aspect of fighting that has been like a uniquely universal sport activity that has kind of transcended all sorts of different cultures.
Yeah. I mean, fighting is sort of it's like the originary manifestation of aggression, right? Just pure combat, putting yourself out there where you completely use your body as a means of, like, to put it bluntly, a means of violence, right? It's sort of the codification and expression of violence.
Yeah. Oh, no, I was just going to say, and you see that like most obviously or probably most famously, you know, as societies over time developed and became more like, in quote unquote, advanced or complex. You know, one thinks about the Roman Empire, where, you know, obviously things like the Colosseum and the gladiatorial games really became like the pinnacle of fighting sports as like the primary central cultural activity of an entire society. Like these were like gladiatorial games became hugely important and huge spectacles and festivals that like enormous amounts of money and wealth were spent on what were spent on to basically watch people kill each other, for lack of my way of saying it. I mean, there was many complicated different forms that went on there, but that's an example where that sort of sport became really complex and fundamental to a really complex and large imperial society that lasted for hundreds of years.
Yeah, I have a series of thoughts that come to mind as you were speaking, Hale. One was, it's interesting how, again, like just purely focusing on fighting for a moment, externally the way fighting is received, again, it's been an archaic thing that we've been doing for forever mm-hmm. now, still highly observed, highly regarded, still highly anticipated. Internally as well, what I have seen with a lot of fighters, myself included, is fighting is extremely artistic. Just as much as it is aggressive and violent, it is a martial, people would say martial art. I don't think I really understood that until I got into it and I watched, oh, I am an artist creating a performance in a certain way, and aggression is built into that. And in the same vein, like, there's a crazy weird correlation between fighters and philosophers. There's a lot of philosophy that happens within fighting, and I think part of it is, I don't know, maybe it's not that people are inherently not aggressive, but people also have to come to terms with their own aggression and figure out a way to accept, do I enjoy hurting people walking down the street? No. So why in this context do I have I met my violence and aggression so deeply and touched it so intimately that I am in there trying to exert as much of it as possible? You know, it's a very, I think that's why you have to rectify those two conflicting things within you.
Yeah, there is a certain kind of paradox to that, right? I mean, it'd be one thing if you just had someone who was actually like a violent, belligerent person and you put them in the ring and you had them fight. Okay, they're going to be really aggressive, but it's almost like, you know, it's like taking uncarved rock and putting it up on a pedestal. You know, it hasn't really, I can't even say it's like, well, you got to shape it, because I don't know if a fighter in particular is even like acting, you know, from a place of violence. It's a place of like, well, okay, I don't really know where I'm going with that. But the other thought I had with that as well is that I think it's really, I think you're bang on when you say that you're kind of like, it's almost like you're painting with aggression in a certain way. You know, aggression is sort of like this medium through which you express something else. And you can see that in like the various styles of martial arts, right? I was also thinking of this when you were talking as well, Hale, about gladiators. I always found it really one of those, like, because, you know, we're philosophers, so we kind of like to strip things down to their bare necessities. I always found it oddly contingent and like weirdly worldly that there were like these classes of gladiators. Like there's the guy with the net and then another guy gets like a shield. There's like these tropes. It's almost like a video game in a weird way. But there's, yeah, choose your fighter, you know. There is something about the gladiatorial practice and the way that it evolved through, like, you know, the Roman culture and the way that codified aggression and that codified violence expressed something about the culture, right? So I guess to that end, there is something to be said about the way that martial arts express something about the way that that particular culture either views or uses or maybe even like represses particular like forms of aggression or violence. And it goes back to that question that you were asking, David, where it's like, okay, well, I'm not like a, you know, this kind of me getting into kind of you here is like, I'm not like a particularly aggressive person. I don't walk down the street and have like violent thoughts. I don't want to beat these people up. And yet, you know, I'm a kind of like, I'm using this form of aggression to express something else. I have to get acquainted with that. And I think that is the interesting thing is like, it's almost like a kind of, you know, like facing your, I don't want to say like facing your demons kind of thing, but there is some kind of balance you have to strike with the relationship that you have to your medium. I think probably like any artist, you know, a painter could understand themselves as being in relationship to the images that their culture has used. And I think a lot of it, the best artists have seen the way that their art is used in the like sort of background form. So like, I know that John Berger's Ways of Seeing is a really great example of him analyzing the way that oil painting was basically used to and predated things like advertising and the construction of, you know, fantasy and conspicuous consumption and whatnot. The best artists are the people who kind of subvert that, right? I almost wonder if fighters have something of that in them, and maybe that's what makes them particularly prone to being philosophical, is that, well, we do live in like a relatively violent culture. You know, we see violence kind of on TV and whatnot, and we have to cultivate our relationship with violence. A fighter is a person who has taken it upon themselves to consciously cultivate that relationship and maybe do something a bit more artistic or expressive with it, and to maybe hone it so that the culture can have something else to kind of like, because I think that's, this goes back to the spectacle of it as well, like very much so, like, you know, the Jays game, a lot of people anticipate MMA fights. I know when I'm seeing family, they're talking about, you know, fights that are coming up or fights that they've seen. It's kind of a cultural touch point as well. It's almost like an outlet for this sort of thing, and the way that a particular fighter might choose to utilize that sort of medium for the expression of cultural violence.
Mark Fisher talks a lot about spectator democracy, and he particularly talks about the aspects of spectator democracy in terms of film and how we go and see and watch. You know, we live in a society that is unequal, a society that is, you know, controlled by, you know, elites or whatever. But that, you know, that system creates things like films and TV shows that allow for outlets for regular people to feel like they're fighting against the system that's deeply unfair because they're watching things like, you know, V for Vendetta or whatever, right? When they're saying, you know, when they're, you know, they're watching that, they're saying, yeah, exactly, society, you know. You know, the people at the top are bad. I totally agree, blah, blah, blah. But then they're just like watching the film and going home and doing nothing, right? So it gives this false sense of participation in revolution. Mm-hmm. Now, I think that there's also this aspect of like bringing that back to certain kinds of sports as violence, where it becomes kind of like, societies will use violent sports as a kind of outlet for that kind of pent-up energy that might already be there within the general population to express their own violent tendencies or their own aggression without actually disrupting the, you know, standard order. So, like, I think the best example of this is, like, things like WWE and, like, you know, like, wrestling and all that kind of stuff, where it becomes this deeply spectacle, deeply, like, you know, kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? But, you know, almost kind of, like, festive thing that people participate in. But then, at the end of the day, they just go home back to their regular lives and regular jobs, and really nothing changes. But because they've been able to participate for at least an hour or two in what seems like a, you know, violent outlet,